All right. Thanks, Drew, for coming on the show. It's great to have you here. So first things first, I always like to start at the beginning. So I think the story of Fishtown and DBT is super compelling and somewhat unique. It's pretty rare that a consulting firm develops a product and kind of pivots successfully. So I'd love to start with just like, how did Fishtown get started? Like what was the focus in the beginning? And then how did kind of DBT get created along the way?
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here. So we started the company about almost 6 years exactly at this point, 6 years ago. We were originally called Fishtown Analytics. We started the company in a neighborhood next to the neighborhood called Fishtown. It's like where the name comes from. The actual origin story of DBT comes from the previous company that we all worked at. It was called RJ Metrics. And RJ Metrics was this all-in-one BI tool. It would do like data loading, transformation, you could define metrics, it did reporting. And what sort of happened was around like 2015, 2016, we kind of saw the rise of the data warehouse. And so like Redshift came to market, people started using it. All of a sudden, RJ Metrics, kind of the all-in-one BI tool, was no longer best in class at, you know, moving data around or transforming data or reporting on data. And so, you know, to the company's credit, they started building, I think, what was originally called the bare bones data pipeline. And it was basically the precursor to Stitch, like the, you know, data movement company that got acquired by Talend and later private equity. So we got the front row seats to kind of the unbundling, if you will, of BI tools, the all-in-one BI tool. And we also saw that, you know, if you pipe data into a data warehouse like Redshift, there's actually a lot of work to do to get that data ready for analysis. So I think it was Tristan that wanted to analyze some like MailChimp data or something like that. And he thought if only there was some way to create views on top of views that would transform the source data, make his BI queries like a lot simpler to write. So we started building DBT. It was originally only on Redshift, and all it could do was create like chains of views based on this like dependency of, you know, one view selecting off another view.
Did you have the ref idea in there, like the ref kind of macro back then, or is that better?
So ref came later. I think originally we could go back in the Git commit history, but I think originally there was like an at symbol, and you would do at, you know, MailChimp campaigns, and then that's how we would identify edges in the DAG between different, you know, views that should select from each other. I really like the at because originally the DBT repo was housed in this GitHub organization called Analyst Collective. That was like the original name for like DBT, the modeling tool, plus a lot of like pre-built packages that do analytics for these common data sets. And so to me, the at symbol kind of looked like an A and the C, like Analyst Collective. I thought that was clever. But at some point we dropped Jinja in. We thought templating could be interesting. And that was, I think, that first summer that DBT existed. Jinja was in there.
That's very cool. I feel like through my experience of like visiting a bunch of companies in the context of like Airflow data engineering, you know, in the Valley, I got to talk to a bunch of teams and then join different teams. And like this idea of having just kind of lightly templated SQL and like the kind of CLI runner, it's definitely like a convergence of ideas where it got invented, you know, multiple times. And Airflow like does a lot of that as Jinja built in too. So like that was kind of a subset like use case for Airflow. But I think like DBT did it like super like the elegance of like the CLI and like the commands and just kind of easy to onboard. The ref thing is kind of a clever kind of spin on how to weave your DAG, right? And it's been kind of interesting. I remember when we made some decisions here about like how we're going to run some SQL at preset for our own data team, I was like, oh, let me try this thing, like, you know, what the hype is all about. And then came to like be like, oh yeah, that's cool, I don't need to install Airflow for another, you know, 3 to 6 months, maybe a year if I push it, you know. And can just start like run DBT run every day. I don't even need like a cron or a Jenkins script on the meantime. So very easy to adopt, kind of easy to learn, good documentation. It was super great.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm glad it's working for you. And truly, we people sometimes ask if DBT and Airflow are competitive, and like to us, they truly are not. Maybe we'll talk about this more a little bit later, but I am supportive of DBT delaying the need for Airflow. I think that if you're just trying to create views and tables, like that's actually a good a good place for it to occupy.
Me too. And that's kind of the path that we follow. I think we're at the point, we could get into that too in this talk on a following one too, of like when things start to break down. And for us, it's more like, it's been really easy to adopt things like DBT, but also like high touch and, you know, Fivetran and a bunch of other things, you know, little solutions that run on their own schedule. At some point you're like, oh my God, I need some place. If I'm going to stay sane, or, you know, with all these systems, I need an orchestrator, but that delays that need by quite a bit, you know? And I think like there's some really interesting, integrations there where people have built, they can understand the DBT DAG and kind of make an Airflow DAG out of it. And then do things like logging on top. So, you know, like what ran when, you know, keep more history, because like the beauty of DBT is it's stateless. It's really easy to get going because it's stateless, but that's also a little bit of a problem when you get into more complex workflows,
right.
You know?
Yeah. You need to orchestrate it at some point. You mentioned how like kind of quick and easy it is to get started with DBT. And I just wanted to come back to the original question about like our origins as a consultancy. And so I think it's really cool. Like a lot of the design decisions in DBT were based around our need to make the consulting work that we did like really easy and efficient and quick. And so the cool thing is like we solved all these analytics problems like over and over and over again with different consulting clients. And we tried to bake right. into the DBT kind of like aesthetic and workflow, like that those easy things should be really easy. And then when we do get, you know, harder, more bespoke requests, like we would always try to build in these escape hatches to make like the hard things possible, I guess is how we say it.
I think consultants that sit at a really interesting place in a lot of cases where they go and rinse and repeat. They see a lot of organizations, they rinse and repeat. They see what's intriguingly similar and intriguingly different from like a company to the next. And then that informs very well, like what is the toolkit that's going to work in most places, all places where you can kind of ramp it up quickly. So I think it's cool. I think there's been other instances of that. The data mesh folks, like, you know, believe what you believe, or, you know, in terms of like joining the cult or not, I think they're sitting in an interesting place. They did a good job at summarizing a lot of the pain points for, you know, organizations because they're consultants. They work with so many people.
I agree. I got a computer science degree, if you can believe it. And the one thing I remember from my software engineering class is a statement like encapsulate what varies. And so you really get to see the variance across different organizations, and then also like the stuff that just is identical. And the more that you can make that identical stuff, like not something that you need to think about, then you're just focusing on the things that are unique to your business.
But the one thing too, when you boil it to its essence, then of like, what is DBT, or and maybe what is the essence of like what the toolkit you need from go to place, it's surprising that it ends up being effectively like SQL, like templated SQL. You know, you would wish it would be like these parametric pipeline that do really complex computation. It would just kind of, you know, maybe can do some of that as, you know, DBT projects or, you know, reusable Airflow DAGs. The reality is like, it's really hard in data to have anything that's kind of cookie cutter that you can reuse from a place to the next.
Yeah. And that's the big insight with DBT. It's just make the work accessible to people that have the domain context of, like about the non-cookie cutter parts of the logic. And so the fact that DBT SQL plus Jinja means that like people without computer science degrees, but that know a lot about marketing or product analytics or sales operations, like they can do the work. And the technology is a little bit less cool than the like hardcore parameterized, like, you know, it's like DBT is going to run your SQL queries in the right order. There's some cool stuff that happens in there, but it really is about like who does the work and the workflow for collaborating with their peers.
Yeah. I mean, one thing there is like, since we know that it's really hard to share constructs. So let's say if I build a pipeline to compute like an A/B testing framework, or if I build like a really complex framework for computing growth and engagement metrics or SaaS metrics, since we know it's like really hard to build something that's going to work for 2, 5, 10, 100 companies, then I think we should share reference implementation more, right? Like, it's like, okay, you can't use it as is. It's probably not gonna work for you. Use a different SQL dialect, but I'm gonna put my code out there. It's open source. You don't use, you know, you fork it, you use it, you inspire yourself, you reuse what you need. So we don't do that enough in data. I don't know if you see that within the DBT community now, a lot of like, hey, here's how I do it, you know, use it if you will.
Yeah, so one cool thing is that I think the GitLab team has open sourced their entire DBT project. EdService is a very cool reference because they're a big company with, you know, open source roots. But yeah, it's, I mean, it feels very similar to what you see in like machine learning with Google. Like the algorithms are public. Who cares? It's the data that's the competitive advantage.
Completely.
Yeah. One question I have actually is, you know, I think it's interesting now looking back on DBT, there's some early decisions that were made that maybe seem obvious in retrospect, like open sourcing it, which again, it seems obvious now, but at that time, like not everything was necessarily being open sourced. And then the decision to build this kind of growing community around it. So I'm just curious, like, you know, you guys could have just kept it as a great tool, as your own IP, done it as a consulting firm thing. So I'm curious, even like, what was the vision around, like, let's open source, let's build a community, let's kind of get it out there.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't think that when we made the repo and picked an Apache 2 license, we thought super hard about what the future would have in store. I think the fundamental belief is that this business logic is too important to be locked up in a proprietary tool. And so that, you know, when we thought about what people are going to do with this, we thought, like, you don't want the vendor to own that logic. Like, you want to own it and it should be portable.
Right.
So that motivated open sourcing it. But, you know, it really didn't feel like step one, go build a community. Like, we put up a public Slack group and linked to it on the homepage, and people just showed up. And then from there, it was a lot of word of mouth, like in the New York data scene and then later the San Francisco data scene and everywhere in between and beyond that since then. But really, like, our, you know, our goal was just like be present, answer questions that people had, like write about the work that we were doing in consulting, the things we were learning. And a lot of our early growth came from just like talking about this burgeoning space where, okay, nowadays everyone knows like all the BI tools, all the data loaders, all the data warehouses, everything between. Like in 2016, it was not super clear how you should be connecting these tools or what goes where or how you should think about it. We just like wrote about the work we were doing.
I think it's addictive too. Like when you start like interacting with a community and people show up and pay attention to your work and ask questions and then they want to contribute, you're like, oh man, that's cool. Like it seems like so worthwhile of your time. So I've had like a similar experience. For me, you know, when I open source Airflow, the idea was very much like, hey, I want for, instead of like the stage for the importance of this or my limit to impact, instead of being limited to Airbnb, you know, as a theater for its impact, I want the world to be, you know, the place in which this can have impact. So that was the motivation. But then it is really addictive. People show up and you care and it's your craft, you know.
So Max, this is a question I've always had for you, but I don't think I've ever asked. It was pretty obvious why I should spend like long nights and weekends working on DBT in the early days. It's like our company's existence was predicated on DBT being at least a little bit successful. What was that like inside of Airbnb? Like, was it a labor of love? Was it your full-time job?
Yeah, very much so. Like, that was all me. Like, no one was like, hey, why don't you go open source this thing and, like, do a better job with the community? It was more, like, trying to build something relevant, you know, and then, like, you know, I'm sure I'm trying to draw like parallels with maybe like scientists. They want to be published, right? And they want people to be quoted, and they want to, someone is like, hey, I'm writing a paper on your paper. Do you want to talk? Like, yeah, this is what I do. This is my craft. This is what I'm building. So it was very much like I was driving relevance. I mean, you want to have impact in your career, right? So I was driving relevance inside of Airbnb first. And then at the same time, I'm like, hey, I'm going to put it in the open and see what happens. And I never thought it was going to become like this gigantic thing. I heard like there's like more, potentially like more than estimated like 100,000 companies using Airflow now. I'm like, what? Like, totally how is that even possible? You know, it's just crazy. That's awesome. That's awesome stuff.
Nice. Awesome. Well, I know that DBT, you know, obviously a lot of the initial design was very much around like ease of adoptability, and especially for small teams that want to move quickly. So I think a natural segue is then to talking about how we use it at Preset. Max, specifically, I'm curious, like early on, like the kind of the early data stack, how it's evolved at Preset, where DBT fits in, and then also some spicy stuff on functional data engineering in DBT as well.
Or it's like the things like, you know, it's like maybe coming with the Airflow mindset, like, you know, what is empowering, but what is limiting too. So there's been like and we can drill into like some of the trade-offs there too. But for us, like how we picked it, it's just like, oh, we need to run. So first we set up Fivetran to like bring a bunch of SaaS data. And then we set up just like our ingestion pipelines for our product analytics. And then you just have a bunch of raw data and BigQuery in our case. And like, okay, now we need to like, you know, create data sets that we can use for visualization or make sense of that. And I was like, oh, you know, what's the hype all about? And then, you know, I need to just run a few SQL scripts with templates and them. And that just ended up like sticking and working pretty well. And now the things that were cool coming in is like looking at the ref implementation as a way to weave your DAG was kind of interesting. I was like, oh, this is clever. I wish I thought of that. and then another thing or two, what else? Where the CLI just like works very well. I think there's cool like syntactic sugar and it works well. What else did I find on the like the documentation, the auto-generated documentation kind of gives you. You're like, oh, I feel like I want to go and put my tags in and I want to go and kind of curate this stuff. And it all works like well, especially at small scale. I like that you could just go and assume that you're going to fully rebuild everything all the time. It's like materialization can be an afterthought. And then you're like, yeah. Oh, later on, like when we get to bigger data, I'll be able to change my like to my, the bigger tables to incremental. So that was all like, you know, easy to adopt. And then where we started fighting like more recently is more like the stuff where you're like, okay, what did the data look like when it ran, you know? And we have issues with like early arriving facts. So maybe like in our source systems, we dump the analytics events in before we scrape the databases. And depending on when it runs, you know, you have to start thinking about like, oh, you don't have sensors like an Airflow. We can say, wait until the scrapes are over. And when the scrapes are over, start running the thing. So it's kind of lack of orchestration.
Yeah.
And
it's starting to get tangled up a little bit. Okay.
At a high level, I don't know if you want to jump like into that too. Like I like snapshots.
We can talk about it, yeah.
Yeah. One thing to get into, I mean, it will get technical and it's like difficult to without the diagrams to talk about some of these things. But one thing that I like to do that's around like functional data engineering, which is the idea of like just having like idempotent deterministic tasks, like pure tasks that if you run a task, and it's usually time bound, like this task will always is guaranteed with the same source to give the same results. Then the DBT approach is a little bit more like catch up or full process, right? Like, you know, you write code that can be incremental that will say, okay, the last date that you have is 3 days ago. The last data of source data you have is 2 days ago. Therefore, I will, you know, catch you up and compile your data, right? It's a build tool. So that works well, but it gets a little bit tricky sometimes to be like, okay, what ran? What did the data look like when it ran? If I rerun my process twice in a row, it's not going to do the same thing. It will do something new, you know?
So I kind of hear where you're coming from, but I don't think I agree with that characterization. Like, idempotence is one of the kind of core tenets of how DBT does its thing. And mm-hmm. I think the difference between the DBT experience and the Airflow experience is that in DBT, the data loading is managed by some other tool. So you mentioned you use Fivetran. Like, yeah. Sure, Fivetran loads data between when you last ran DBT and when you run it now, like you'll get different outputs. But in the general case, if you're using, you know, DBT view table incremental materializations, like if your source data hasn't changed, you can run DBT 1,000 times and you'll get identical outputs. And specifically, you mentioned this earlier, like you can drop your analytics schema and rebuild everything from scratch. Like it is super intended to be idempotent for kind of the reasons you're describing, I think.
Yeah, and maybe like the best way to describe maybe what I'm trying to talk about are one of the core differences in Airflow, like the schedule is built in very deeply. The time component is like very, you know, Airflow is a scheduler and orchestrator, but like it's assumed that you say your DAG runs daily and then your task instance is like bound to time. So you can say like this task instance, you know, loaded that partition. And DBT, it's more like, oh, when I ran DBT run, it caught me up. And, you know, in theory, if I rerun it like five times or if I'd run it six times between, you know, over the past week or run it now, I can, like, if people have done their work properly, it should lead to the same results, you know. And then there are places where it doesn't. I'll give you an example of like a place that, you know, kind of a surprise debugging data one day. It was just like, think we had like something based on current date, saying like a process the day before current date. And during a DBT run around midnight UTC, like current date during the run, you know, shifted. So then you're like, okay, you know, or was the segment data there? Was the scrape there? You know, my six different sources that lend a different time, like what did it look like when it run? It's kind of like, you know, the essence of it.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny because I've written a good amount of DBT code in my life, and like these aren't challenges that I tend to experience. And I think it points to the different mindset and approach between like the airflow centric versus DBT centric. And so really we want to shed the notion of like days and partitions and like peel all that away, because if you think about it, like your goal is to transform your source data sets into these model data sets. And the fact that the data is comprised of days and like you're running it at a specific time, like that actually isn't so relevant if you're thinking about it in terms of the transformation from the input to the output. Right. And so you could do things like, what I will say is there's a variable built into DBT called run started at that you could use.
That
will not change your
global Jinja context. Yeah.
Yeah. But beyond that,
the problem like the current date, right? Like issue that helps with that. You know.
Yeah. I think that was a community contribution, if I'm not mistaken. Probably from someone who was coming from Airflow. You know, you could write SQL to say like ignore any data that has arrived before midnight, you know, UTC, like the previous midnight. And then you'll always be one day behind, but you'll have like that sort of consistency.
And another example, I'll let you finish your talk too. I have another example of like where things get a little bit intricate.
Yeah, sure. It really just comes down to like, what are the constraints you're working with? And if we say this often, like if you're okay with data from yesterday and prior, like you get really good consistency guarantees. You avoid problems where you mentioned early arriving facts, which is like not actually a term that I've heard before, but makes sense and is funny. you can like guarantee consistency that way, but it is a trade-off between like freshness and sort of internal consistency, I suppose.
Right. So this stuff, like the to get into the early or arriving facts example. So for us, like our analytics events land through segment and they stream into BigQuery. Like they're kind of batched up by like 2 to 4 hours. So they come in kind of regularly throughout the day. And then we run our scrapes now, which scrapes our product, like production databases or, you know, replicas of it. And you know, flush that into the warehouse. That lands at like midnight plus, you know, 10 hours plus or minus like 4 hours of standard deviation. So we don't really know where it's at. So when we process, you know, yesterday, and we've had instances too where the scrapes are just missing too, like for whatever reason, like the job that scrapes the database is not there. So I think we need to just have a better, like more DBT incremental logic around what is really the date range that you can process right now and look at the latest, like, good day of scrape and the latest good day. And then, you know, based on that, there's a fair amount of logic to figure out what's processable to limit, to prevent loading these early arriving facts. The issue is they don't have dimensional context, right? So you have you might have a customer ID without a parameter of like, you know, their gender, their demographics. Yeah. So maybe you load it, you reload it the day after and enrich it. Then that's a trade-off. And that's also mutations, you know?
Sure. Well, one of the things we do is we just set a look back window on the incremental model. And so we'll always reprocess the last, you know, 3 days of data. And you can actually use a variable to configure that. So it sounds kind of similar to what you're doing, but it sort of bypasses the need in most cases to like think super hard about backfills. It's just like every time DBT runs, it'll reprocess 3 days of data. And unless you have like a monstrously large table that you couldn't possibly reprocess more than one day of data at a time for, it's fine.
Yeah, I think that part, then it leads to like, oh, maybe the last day has like, you know, not fully ripened yet. So maybe you always have like your last, let's say 24 hours might, you know, comprise some early arriving facts that are a little bit wrong. And, you know, if you were to, you know, publish a number on yesterday's data, it might change a little bit tomorrow as we know more about yesterday's data. And you know, there's some trade-offs there. I think a lot of the content that I've written around like around functional data engineering was to be like strict and very kind of like, you know, like immutable data set, deterministic tasks, or you really know, like, if I run this job with the same source data, with the same source partition, like my DAGA partition is really solid. But that's quite a burden, right? Like to carry that with you everywhere you go to have to think about every single run and date range and backfills as a, you know, as a collection of task instances, it gets kind of tricky.
So this is not my area of expertise, but I've been kind of loosely following some of the table format discourse that's been happening. Like Iceberg is one of these. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what, right. Delta Late.
Yeah, what do you make of?
I'm not sure if I'm fully up to speed with like Delta Late and Iceberg, but I think it's, to me, I see like as an evolution of the Hive Metastore, which was like insufficient, a little too stupid to like to really support, to be like an important part of the modern deconstructed database like engine. So it turned out like things like Presto and like Druid and other databases started using the Hive Metastore, and I think like it brings in some cool like time traveling aspect to things, right? Like the keeping track of like what changed over time. And I think it's a cool evolution of things. And then there's a lot to be done on this like data access layer. It's also like somewhere in between like your lake and your warehouse, like somewhere it bridges the, you know, something like S3 or HDFS with the data warehouse world, you know, or making it look like it's not just like files on a file on a gigantic system. It makes it look like it's an actual, you know, tabular data sets on top of this stuff.
Yeah. I was just reading the paper yesterday, actually. It's funny timing. And now there's a Delta Lake paper that talks about Iceberg, but basically it's like, it's kind of what you're saying, right? Like it was like, let's just use Hive Metastore and we'll just do a separate relational database. It'll just keep track of files and information. And I think it was like, they're just running into limitations. Like why don't we have a smarter file format that was a little bit more informed about the data instead of just like, hey, this is just, you know, CSV or JSON or whatever.
It's not a file format though, right? Because it's not Parquet is an alternative, a superior alternative to say CSV. This is more like the map of like how you make a data lake look and feel like a data warehouse, you know, or something like that. There's a really cool idea that I was thinking about before these papers, these technology came in was, you know, a table is really just a collection of partitions. And every time that you, every time that you modify a partition, insert a partition, or delete a partition, then you can think of your table just being a different collection of partition in time. So what these file system allow you to, what this abstraction allows you to do is to say like, oh, at any point in time, my table was a different set of partitions, and keeping like time traveling debugger or time traveling, you know, history.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to put it together, like, does that change anything in your mind about sort of operating on individual, like, you know, files as like date partitions in the functional data engineering paradigm?
Not really. It's more I would keep track of like, you, so basically maybe it's more okay to mutate because you always have the history of what changed. But like the problem with this change, if you're going to do a lot of mutations, then the garbage collections become prohibitive. Or like, let's say if you have something like Iceberg on a partition table and in DBT you run full refresh all the time, then it's going to keep track of all the partitions. The more mutations you do, the more it has to like keep track of more files on the file system. Like it becomes prohibitive. So it's still, I mean, I still really like the beautiful idea to say like a task is like predilected on a date range, you know, and like, given the same input partition with the same task running on the same date range, that it, you know for sure that you will get to the exact same result, you know, and that allows you as a data engineer to say, what happened on this run? And what, you know, one thing with DBT now is like, I don't know what the data looked like or what ran 6 weeks ago, right? Or, you know, the history of my runs. And maybe that's all by DBT Cloud in some ways, but to say like, what did I run? What was the, like when I ran the process yesterday, when Jenkins, you know, ran yesterday's run, did it run 3 days or did it just run the day before? Right? Was the data loaded or not loaded? I don't know. I can just look at like, I can only trust that when I ran it, it got me to where I told it to go, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Which is good.
That's fair.
Like, guarantees for most people, right? Like that's, that's like, okay, write code that when you run it brings you to the target, you know, and that works well.
Okay. I think that like there certainly are a lot of machinations inside of Airflow to be very, very explicit about these things. I also think that they manifest as like overhead, and it makes it actually pretty hard for people to like participate in the work.
Yes.
I did say at this top, it's not, they're not competitive. It's not DBT versus Airflow, but I'll like fight for the DBT workflow. Like yeah, the tools can work together, but I want to feel more like DBT where I'm like outcome oriented. Like what do I want to produce? Than like input oriented, which is like, what are the files? What happens to them? Like yeah, it's overhead that it's not like super helpful in the vast majority of cases.
I think it's the freedom of choice, right? I think, I think in Airflow, you can use this thing, like a task can specify it's a catch-up task. And, you know, it won't try to run all the instances of the task. It will just run the latest one and say, like, I don't need to run all the instances of it. But yeah, I think you have to look at the context from which it comes to, which is like, you know, exabyte scale, data warehouse, where everything is partitioned. And you, totally. There's no, at Facebook, you cannot run like a create table as like, you know, a replace table. There's just like way too much data. So everything had to be incremental. Everything had to run daily. You had to be able to look at the log of every run and see like, if we had a bad, you know, Hive or Spark day, like what happened during that run that was supposed to run that date, you know? So it's coming from a different place. And it's, you know, it provides a different set of like constraints and guarantees, you know, that's kind of what it comes
totally
down
by
to.
Totally by that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Makes sense. Cool. So let's, you know, I'd love to switch gears just a little bit and talk about the metrics layer. So I've heard through the grapevine, I'm kidding, you guys have been pretty public about it, that DBT has been building kind of a metrics layer. So I'm curious, you know, what, maybe first, I'd love to hear your own definition of like semantic layer versus metrics layer. I think it's always interesting to hear. And then kind of transition to like, you know, what's kind of the goal of the metrics layer that you guys, like what are the kind of design constraints you guys are optimizing for? Basically, and what's the vision for DBT's metrics layer?
Yeah, right. So, like, you talk about like metrics layer from an abstract perspective first, like what is a metrics layer and why would someone have one? And then what is, you know, DBT's metric layer? But
yeah, absolutely.
I can summarize like what is a metrics layer? Why do we need one?
Yeah. Business metrics have existed for as long as businesses and number systems have existed. The idea of, you know, defining metrics is not new. I think when people talk about metrics layers or semantic layers, the idea is defining these metrics in one place and making them accessible to lots and lots of different tools, potentially like used by different teams for different purposes. So that's very much what we're targeting in the thing that we're currently calling the DBT semantic layer. We can get into that too. But the big idea is you've got these very important business metrics like your OKRs or revenue or churn rate or whatever it is. And you want to track these things. And when you report on them, you want to do so extremely precisely and extremely accurately. Like you don't want to have a chart that says revenue that's a different number than another chart that says revenue. Right. Like you want that to be the exact same definition. So, you know, we kind of saw how we could achieve something similar to that with DBT as a, you know, batch-based transformation tool. It's like you put the stuff in version control. You sort of manage like who can merge to main, and you get code reviews and you test it. And, yeah, exactly. So the big idea is you can define your metrics in your DBT project. These metrics are defined in terms of your models. And so the kind of cool insight here is when you think about a metric like revenue, it's not just the actual expression of, you know, sum of order total minus tax paid or whatever. It's actually all the transformation logic that happened up to that point that defines like the entirety of these metrics. So it's a pretty natural home for the metrics. DBT's like open source origins sort of play a big role here too. Like there are lots of different tools that like could have a stake for being the one-stop shop in which all of your metrics are defined. But we think it's important that like fundamentally they are sort of built in an open source ecosystem and you can take them with you and use it yourself.
In source control, yeah, they need to be in source controlled and code reviewer if you desire so. And they need to be in something open source and universal that multiple tools can use, right? Because if you put it in Looker's LookML or like some proprietary tool out there, you're like, okay, how is everyone going to integrate and really serve from that awesome catalog, you know, that should be centralized and usable by everyone? So DBT is a decently good place to do that. It's just something like DBT is so like model centric when you think about it, like, and it's information architecture, everything's around models, and then metric kind of comes over as a new like cross model, really important, you know, entity in your information architecture.
Yeah, exactly. So the goal here with what we're building is to create a sort of SQL like interface into querying those metrics. And so you can sort of issue a query. I won't describe the Jinja out loud, but you can more or less select star from, you know, metric revenue and say, I want to look at it, you know, weekly or quarterly. I want to look at it by country or tier. And then DBT can compile the sort of version control code to calculate that metric for you. And the great thing is if you ever release new product and now you're changing the definition of revenue, it's actually whatever, say it's services plus product revenue. You can change that definition in DBT and not need to update any chart or query that references the metric. That'll kind of happen within DBT's semantic layer.
The thing with metric is like they can't really be decoupled from their dimension, right? So because, you know, now we have like call it like metric centric data modeling, right? Like where like metric becomes a really important thing that you think about when you do your data models. But then you have to think about like what is the dimensionality of these metrics, and then what is the physical representation of these metrics, which I think like you guys, like, you know, that's probably your primary like concern, to be like, okay, how does the metric live across multiple models? But were you suggesting what you can say select star from, you know, a metric or a metric abstraction, and it would figure out which models to hit? Is this the general idea?
Yeah, exactly. So the sort of prior art here looks more like OLAP cubes, where the idea is you calculate the metric across every specified dimension, store that in a table. And then when you want to know the metric value, you select star from that table with whatever filters you want to apply. OLAP cubes don't really make a lot of sense in the data warehousing world. I think they're more a function of like the previous era of technology. And so what we kind of do with the semantic layer is virtualize. This is like it's a Jinja macro. Like it's a Jinja macro, but it's a really cool Jinja macro. So you select star from this macro and it'll expand to a much bigger query that actually calculates the metric precisely from all your source tables.
But the from clause like points to a data set, not a metric, right? You would think like select metric from, any data set that has it or something like that. But like the from, so like it's, so then the, when you say a metric baked into it is right? Like the metric cannot really be decoupled from the columns that can or cannot live with it.
So like, you can think of it like a table function almost, if you're familiar. So it's, there's no actual backing table, but you can select from it as though it was a table. And so what you can do is select from the revenue metric, select from the, like customers metric, ARPC, revenue per customer, like it'll do a ratio. That's sort of the, for lack of a better term, the vibe, the aesthetic we're going for. We want it to feel like you're selecting from a concrete data set, but really it's virtualized and only exists kind of at query time based on the dimensions that you're asking for.
So the from clause kind of imply more a cube than a metric, right? It's something like that to me, because like from means you're querying from a collection of fields that include metrics. So revenue, but there's also like country and, you know, demographics and things like that.
So the problem is dimensionality. Like that's what it would feel like in the cube world. But say that you have a customers table and there's 10 dimensions that you could conceivably group this customer count by. And each of those 10 dimensions has between 10 and 100 different possibilities. Like all of a sudden this table, if you were to materialize it, is billions of rows because it's every permutation of every dimension, right?
Yeah.
So when we think about it as like sort of a table function, like select star from the revenue metric, the columns inside of that data set are the timestamp that you specified. So like quarterly or week over week, whatever it is. It's all the dimensions that you've specified. So by country and tier. And then the last column is like the metric value. So the revenue for all those dimensions in that time range.
Got it. And behind the scene, you know, it's a little bit like there's this notion that's also an old term, but we're talking about OLAP, so it's okay to bring the old terms. But one is like called aggregate awareness. It's a feature of semantic layers where, you know, it will know which underlying representation is most efficient to query to answer your question. So if you say like select country and customer count, it's like, oh, I have a table that's like really small, really effective to answer to that. So that's aggregate awareness. There's some challenges with like, so if you have a bunch of different like physical representation of different combination of dimensions, there's some dimensions that you cannot look at together. They may not exist together unless you have a, you know, what Vertigo would call a super projection or something like that, a place that has it all, you know, and that's like the ultimate source that has like the level of detail with all the dimensions defined. Yeah, is that the way it works behind the scene? Like you, like kind of like wiring you to the right, the best materialization to answer the query?
No, we just run the query against the table. There's a little more to it. Like, so we'll build these, we call them spines. Like there's the date spine. So for instance, if there are no orders the week of June 13th, just say, you still want to see June 13th show up with zero orders. So yeah. We'll spine your time periods. We'll spine your dimensions. So if there were no orders the week of June 13th in Canada, you'll still see zero. But fundamentally, we've run an aggregate against the underlying table that you've specified. So revenue is the sum of order total minus tax paid. We'll just run that query. And the thing that feels right to us is that's the query that you're running in your BI tool today anyway. So like, it doesn't feel intractable. Like if you're reporting on these metrics, then it's just a more consistent way to run basically the same query.
From this, I think from the original GitHub issue that I read through, my impression too that you're gonna elevate like the metric idea to possibly live across multiple models, right? So that means that maybe revenue as represented in different ways, in different like sets of aggregates or you know, different models, is that still the case? So there's still like the UDTF that user defined you know, table function that's able to say like, oh, where should I wire this? You know, and maybe, is that the case?
Yeah. And so to be clear, it isn't actually a user defined table function. It just sort of feels like it is one. Like it's really a Jinja macro that compiles to a subquery basically. But yeah, we're actually just this week, I was working with some folks on the team implementing these sort of composite metrics. So any ratio metric is a good example, revenue divided by customers to get average revenue per customer. Like, those are going to come from different tables. And I think we have a good answer for how we'll support that via
union
the magic of Jinja.
Yeah, I think you can like certainly like solve some of these. Yeah, it's like bringing kind of different data sets together to compute ratios across them. That's a cool idea.
This has been like the biggest insight throughout all of DBT's journey. It's just like, trust the data warehouse. Like data warehouses are good at running SQL. They've gotten better and faster and more ergonomic over time. Like if you're going to pick something to invest in, maybe stock market notwithstanding, but technology wise, like data warehouses are a great bet.
Yeah. So, and then like transpiling to SQL, you know, or like even like SQL that transpiles to SQL in some cases, not that crazy. And in this day and age, like wherever we kind of ended up, you know, and in this, you know, analytics journey, right? Like data teams around the world, it's like I've made a lot of choices. And I think in this, I used to think that, you know, transpiling SQL is a crazy thing that you would have to understand the SQL and write new one. And then, you know, and I think like in this day and age, I think it seems like a reasonable thing to do.
So this is my white whale. Like we were talking before we jumped on, but you know, I used to be the chief product officer. I stepped down. I'm an IC now working on sort of like, maybe you could say DBT next. So for us right now, it's a semantic layer. And in the future, I would really be excited to work on like SQL parsing, analysis, transpilation, things like that. I think it's so compelling. And the way that we talk about it internally is it's kind of like what TypeScript did for JavaScript. Like there's an opportunity to do something similar, I think, for SQL without making it feel like a different language. Like it might... Hopefully it still feels like SQL, but with the ability to compile
it. When you first brought it up, I was like, oh my God, transpiling SQL. Like if you've done any like SQL generation and SQL parsing, and both of them, I'm sure like we've done like more than we should, or like, you know, it's a crazy thing to do, like using stuff like, what's the name of the SQL parser, ParseSQL in Python? I don't know. Like
SQL parse.
Yeah, just working with SQL parse and things like that. It just seems like kind of crazy, but I like the idea of, you know, the moment you mentioned like TypeScript to JavaScript, like X to SQL, I think is a cool idea, like kind of a super SQL or meta SQL. The dialect issue is something that we both, I'm sure, like have struggled with too. Like, you know, I wrote a lot of the superset code, the abstraction that allows superset to talk with the different flavors and dialects of SQL. Yeah. Such a pain in the ass. Like it makes our life impossible, despite NC SQL like being a pretty good standard that's pretty well adopted.
Yeah. Until you've done stuff like this, you don't realize all the quirks. Like this came up this morning. I know y'all use BigQuery. I was writing some example like pseudocode SQL, and I looked at it, I was like, oh, this wouldn't run on BigQuery because I have a column that's the same name as the table, and BigQuery is gonna think that I'm addressing the table, not the column inside the table. It's just like the amount of stuff that I know about data warehouses, it's like overwhelming. But you got to know it if you're going to build this kind of tooling.
You know, one thing that would really help is like having much more of the same, like not UDF, but it's just like having all the database vendors have the same like date trunk function. And I think that's part of NC SQL now too, but there's still quirks and subtleties here and there, you know.
This, Max, this blows my mind. Like the date trunk or like date add whatever functions are part of the grammars. It's like how you can have that day or week or month keyword not quoted as like a literal. It's like a part of the grammar.
It's part of the SQL the SQL NC SQL grammar, you mean? But that doesn't mean it's implemented the same way in dialects, right?
Agree. Yeah, but like it's not like a user space function. It's like baked into the language grammar that date add works.
And,
like
and there's
this.
And there's still so much variation. I guess is the point you're making, right? Awful. It's like it's something that I mean. I know in Superset, like I've written at least one database engine spec, and the one thing you absolutely need is like date. Like how does date trunk work? That's like to support every database. It's like that's the minimum you need. And Superset is like, well, we at least gotta know how to do this type of date time grain stuff, which is
there's
funny.
A bunch Postgres. Of other there's a module and the superset code base under superset / db engine spec, which is everything that is database engine specific. All of the methods and constants and translations, there's some driver level stuff, there's some dialect stuff, but and there's a lot of code in there because there's a lot of shit that is just like not doesn't work the same way across drivers and database dialects.
Right on.
So bring it back. So kind of bridging to BI and metrics layers. I'm curious, like, it sounds kind of like the DBT, I guess, are you guys calling it the DBT metrics layer or DBT semantic layer?
We're rolling with semantic layer for
okay.
Yeah.
So the DBT semantic layer, you guys are kind of, it sounds kind of like you want BI tools or whatever tools that are going to plug into this to treat it a little bit like a database. Is that kind of a fair characterization? And I'm curious then, like, what are the limitations of that like approach, or like what are things you wish like more upstream tools like would concern themselves with, you know, when querying DBT's like semantic layer?
Yeah. So just like one sentence on semantic layer versus metrics layer. DBT, for as much as it knows about data lineage and provenance for your models, it knows so very little about how your models relate to each other. So even if you're not doing like a full-on star or snowflake schema, like knowing that the customers table joins to the orders table on the customer ID column, like that's something that DBT should know about. And, you know, when we do teach DBT about these relationships, it's going to be able to pull through into sort of the metrics capabilities. So we're definitely looking for this thing to be like aware of the relationships between your different data sets. And that's a really deep well, I guess we can get into sort of all that entails, and we have a lot of respect for the problem. To be clear,
that's a problem that I've learned a lot about around the years, because at first I was a business objects universe designer, so business object had a pretty good semantic layer, a pretty advanced one, and then MicroStrategy project knew a lot about, you know, tables, how they can be joined. A lot of business metadata in there, aggregate awareness. So they both, add this. And then more recently, LookML, Express as Code, which I think is much closer to probably what you're thinking about, right? The problem is probably, the way you're probably thinking about it is a subset of the LookML use case and eventually growing into a superset maybe of like the what LookML kind of knows about and can operate on.
Yeah. Do you smile every time you use the word superset in a sentence? Like
I do,
yeah, I do that with Materialize.
I got to be careful. Yeah, but whether I mean which ones of the term superset I'm using,
right.
I got to specify
capital S or lowercase
S or not. Yeah,
yeah. So totally. Like I'll just say we have a different query model than I think the one that Looker uses. Like Looker's model is all about join everything together and then aggregate it and then you're done. And the result is that if you have these fan out queries, it does this metric aggregates and you get this like completely unreadable query that MD5's numbers to, it's just like no mere mortal could interpret what the query is actually doing. Mm-hmm. Our model, it feels a little bit more like aggregate and then join. There's some more nuance there, but the idea is you can calculate all these metrics based on the tables that they come from and then join them together on shared dimensions. So it kind of obviates the need for a lot of the really challenging, but not super value additive, I think, aspects of the join then aggregate model, where you do need to worry about fan outs and not double counting records, things like that.
Yeah, it's like for people in the audience that don't know about that, like the fan out problem is the issue that if you have a metric on a table and then there's you express a one to many relationship or many to many relationship to another table and you want the detail from that table, that metric gets exploded and repeated and it's probably wrong, so you're just not supposed to do that. So semantic layers might, tell you that you cannot use, it might use something like context or run multiple queries to be able to get the details and bring it together. And it gets pretty complicated and tricky. But here's a thought, like something that that I've been thinking about a lot is, the semantic layer on top of, so the transform layer is immensely complicated, right? Like everything that happens in DBT and that provenance and lineage and transformation, the complexity is kind of infinite there. It's finite, but extremely complex and kind of moving target, right? So there's a lot of complexity there. And then often if you use something like LookML or Business Object Universes, then on top of that, you have this new layer that's also like equally complicated, to try to piece it back together and make sense of it. And then, how much the cognitive load of having not only a complex transform layer and then a complex semantic layer and the change management on any of these things by itself is a monster. If you try to couple them together and evolve them together, you end up like failing miserably. People like basically don't want to touch the data model ever because they know they're going to break everything. So I think like pushing to have a single abstraction to do it all makes a lot of sense. Like push the semantic layer in the transform layer, at least like it should live together as code, be deployed atomically, be run and executed atomically. So I think it makes tons of sense to move it there. And another thought building up on this thought is tabular data sets are so easy to reason about. Like if you can expose people like, things that looks like an Excel file, like columns and rows, yeah. It makes a really great interface for humans and BI tools, So like Tableau as extract superset uses data sets. I think it's nice if the transform layer can deliver data sets or something that looks and feels like data sets, like that looks like abstractly as like tabular things. And then BI tools can just tap into that, complexity push to the transform layer, to the metrics layer.
Yeah, I really buy that. I think that, we can't just release this semantic layer and say, okay, everyone, like, have a great time. Like, I think there's a lot of work to do for us to kind of write about our experiences and like what we think the best practices are for how to model your data, and if it looks more like a star schema or more like denormalization, or when to choose one approach versus the other. Like, it's going to force us to ask and answer questions that we just like haven't really needed to discuss or think too hard about before. I think that's kind of exciting. Like, this was very true back in 2017, 2018, when the DBT community was writing about best practices. Like, okay, we can do this 10 different ways. What's the best way, or when do we choose one way versus the other? It will sort of bring us back to that grounded and very practical, and I think very interesting set of conversations.
Yeah. So much stuff to talk about here too, but like, you know, in some ways, like thinking about the materialization of that. So if we agree like loosely that that's like tabular data set is a great kind of abstraction for BI tools and humans to interact with, then you're like, okay, now like what should be materialized or not materialized or incrementally or not, right? It's like how you're going to cube the stuff and pre-aggregate and store aggregate, becomes an intricate, complex question. It's similar to like when we're talking about airflow versus DBT and the constraint and guarantee idea. Like it'd be so great in DBT if instead of saying materialization is equal to table incremental view, I would just say like, let the freaking database decide based on usage pattern, right? So it maybe eventually DBT would just say like, everything is a view, you know, and the database figure out what you need to materialize based on usage pattern that day, you know? I don't know if that's cool. Is it a DBT problem or a database problem? Figuring out what to store, what to materialize dynamically based on usage patterns.
I think DBT could do a lot more here. I think we don't currently have any plans to wade into those waters, but in terms of the information that we have, like historically we've known the models that exist, how they are materialized, and really like pretty limited insight into like query times against those tables. Like we'll know how long they took to build. We don't really know what the experience is like of querying them. And so it would be kind of interesting to just imagine like, oh, we can make better materialization decisions. The hard thing is when you go to incrementalize models, like you need to, like view and table is kind of easy. Like you just flip a config. But if you go, oh, this is table and now I want to build it incrementally, like you got to write some code. You got to add some logic.
Yeah, you got to do some thinking about early arriving facts and the kind of stuff and functional data engineering or not, you know, that kind of stuff.
Non-functional data engineering. Which is what it's called when I do it.
Dysfunctional data engineering.
Yeah, yours is better.
You know, I think like that's an interesting part, the part where you said like DBT does not know how the tables are used, right? And then the BI tool like is trying to make it easy for people to use the model. So I think like, you know, when I came into that issue, talk about the metrics layer in DBT, I was like, oh, in Superset today, we take your model, the DBT model as it is, and we add information as to how, you know, it can be queried. So we add pretty labels, which you have in DBT, like long descriptions, so people can know, you know, the fields and columns they're dealing with. Then metric, like aggregate expressions, like what is, you know, the sum of, you know, revenue minus tax or whatever it is, right? So that's like the metric layer as it pertains to models. So I think like to let that information be stored alongside models for BI tools to tap into is such a no-brainer, right? Like so that means like, you know, so for us, we've built an integration with Superset where in your DBT models, you can augment the meta tag in your YAML to say like, hey, I'm gonna give you an array of metrics or what we call calculated dimensions. There's just like expressions that you don't wanna materialize. So sometimes like, you know, you might have something that's like a day trunk of month. Like you don't wanna go and store like the day trunk of like, you know, month, day, second, minute and all this stuff and store it. So these more like compute time, like, you know, useful expressions that, you know, we wanna give access to. So, you know, so in our integration, it allows people to manage their Superset data sets, you know, alongside their DBT model. So that means like your DBT model is augmented with like metric semantics, which is different than your metric semantic from your semantic layer, maybe, or I'm not sure exactly how it relates. It's more like right now for us, it's like kind of Superset meta specific information. So you can have it in source control. And that's, you know, the extent of it, and that already bridges the two worlds, you know, in a really, really nice way.
Sure. So we do some like performance analysis, and the thing that always kills me is needing to, you know, create five different columns for the 25th, 50th, 75th, 95th, 99th percentile. I'm just like, I don't want to create all these different columns. Like they don't actually need to exist, but I also don't want to copy and paste the percentile continuous function every time I want to analyze it. So that concept of like virtualized columns is pretty interesting. It's not currently something we support in DBT, like from core itself, but it's really cool that you're able to find a way to like find that integration point via the meta flag, or the meta config.
Can you do Jinja and YAML? Right, you can. So like you could do a for loop that says like for each percentile, you know, by 0.1, 0.2, like all like, you know, by increment of 0.05 to.
The problem is more like, I don't want to expose that as surface area of the table. Like in the data warehouse, you know, it's not that like you can't generate the code to create the columns. It's like, I don't think we should have columns for, you know, 7 different entiles.
Yeah, it just gets nasty. Yeah, it's like a derived, it's really a virtual column in some ways.
Right.
It's an expression, it's a reusable expression that's really useful for this table.
Right? So it's especially, you know, if you have some sort of model that's measuring performance of a thing, there's probably like, you know, just say 5 or 6 different like steps that you can measure. And so suddenly if you've got 5 entiles per step and 5 steps, you've got like 25 columns that it's just like junk, right? Like, I think virtual columns are cool.
And specifically percentile is non-additive metrics too. So you absolutely cannot materialize those or they will be wrong on like a subsequent aggregation.
You're totally right. Yeah.
So it is kind of troublesome, which brings like the philosophy thing of like, hey, I don't want to expose columns that, you know, are not useful in the warehouse. So there's a similar question. So recently I did my first DBT code contribution. It was more like a conversation sparker. I was looking for a way to to augment the Jinja context. So to add a new macro as a Python function, right? And, you know, as I mentioned before, it's like there's like probably 6 different ways you can do that in Airflow, like to augment your Jinja context for a task, for a DAG, for as a global. And I was like, oh, there's got to be a way I can do this, you know, with DBT. And then I'm looking at the code base, I'm grepping for import lib, you know, and I'm like looking in the config for a config file for a hook. I'm like, there's no way to do this. I'm like, well, certainly DBT utils, you know, expresses that stuff. So I'll just go look at the source code of DBT utils to see how it's done. Then realize that it's all Jinja, like very kind of hard to maintain, like hard to read, hard to write, you know, Jinja code. So there, I think the philosophy is like, oh, do we want to like allow people to do this really powerful thing, but they, you know, they could shoot themselves in the foot, you know, and they, that might be a horse for like a bunch of things we might not want. So curious to hear like how you're thinking about that and more the philosophy of like, hey, in this community, maybe like we're careful to expose things to people that are potentially like hard to manage and maintain for the community or for, you know.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that DBT has been successful because of the constraints that it imposes, not despite them. Like we talked about adempotence earlier. I actually saw a funny tweet about how every time you say the word adempotence, you can pronounce it differently. And I think I did that 2 different ways in this one call. But okay, like environment awareness, like you could have a dev staging prod environment. DBT makes this really natural out of the box. The ability to, I mean, kind of hand in hand with adempotence, but like delete your analytic schema, rebuild it from scratch, feel confident that it'll be correct. The other really big part of this too is like, you can run it anywhere, like on a Raspberry Pi, not that you're doing that, but as an analog for like some of the work machines that people use, like you're not doing stuff kind of in Python on your machine. It's all happening as orchestration and the queries get sent to the data warehouse. We think that ends up being really powerful.
That being able to like for a peer to for me to share my project with you and be like the guarantee you have to run it without installing some library or setting up some environment.
Yeah.
So you do have some stuff already there, right? There is like a profiles.xml or something, or sorry, not XML, but some sort of a YAML file, you know, that you might, you know, to set up. But I think like when you say the constraint that it, like it's successful because the constraint that it enforces, I think it's like successful because it's the right set. It's like the intricate, you know, figuring out what the exact set of constraints and variable, what the constants of what the variables are, you know, and this one is like on the edge of debatability maybe, right?
So what I will say is like, we are pretty strongly opinionated about the fact that DBT shouldn't let you run arbitrary Python on your machine, but we are in fact very in favor of running arbitrary Python on someone else's machine, specifically like the data warehouse. So we've been tracking stuff like Snowpark from Snowflake, and we're thinking about how to integrate with like PySpark on different data warehouses. Of course, Databricks, there are others that have like more serverless Spark capabilities. So GCP in particular, I think we're like exploring at this point. I think that's all public enough for me to say out loud. I hope it is. I think Jeremy, our PM for Quark, wrote about this recently. So I can like share links. We want dbt to support Python, like it's going to. It's just not going to augment the client.
That's so smart to just be like, I know how much of a can of worms that is, like run someone else's Python code, given especially, you know, like jars and Java are a little bit more, you know, predictable and useful and easy to package. But yeah, and Python is just like if we have this problem with Airflow, you know, in some ways where we have to deal with like, you know, just arbitrary Python libraries and, you know, some issues. There's not a good sandboxing either, you know, in Python today.
It's really hard.
I know. So that makes it tough.
We have issues where like DBT's dependencies aren't installable sometimes because somebody like breaks a distribution of some time zone library or whatever. And it's just like, ugh, arbitrary packages that you include that you coordinate across dozens of analytics engineers. Like, it doesn't sound like a fun problem to solve or to impose upon users.
Yeah, but I think it's one of these things though where you could say too, like, hey, you know, we expose a hook and we put a bunch of red tape around it and say like, if you're gonna use this hook, like here's what you give up, you know, on and all the door that it closes, and we're not gonna support you, and be really cautious around that. And so it's like a little bit like giving a hammer to a kid, and there are some like very, very educated people that know exactly what they're doing too, right? So it's just like giving general access to like a hammer to a lot of people, and you know, and then just putting the right amount of tape around it potentially, right? Because like in a lot of cases you might just want to use the standard library, right? You think about like dbt utils as a package, it would be a better packet, or it'd be more maintainable, more testable, probably better as like a set of Python functions,
right? I partially agree with that. I think anytime you're doing like string templating, interpolation, like actually Jinja is good at doing that. It's just when you start manipulating data structures and you're trying to do that inside of Jinja that it's kind of gross. So I don't know. One of the things I'm interested in figuring out is if we can use, I don't know exactly what's public and what's not, so I'll be unfortunately vague, but like just say like UDFs or maybe potentially non-SQL UDFs on different data warehouses as like a way to actually help people write code in Python that runs on the data warehouse. And then the question for us is like, how do we tap into the kind of dbt test framework that exists so that you can write, you know, unit tests in Python? Like, we like Python. We wrote dbt in Python. It's just a question of like what the programming environment is and how readily we can support it.
Yeah, that's a smart idea. Like, I like the idea of saying like, you know, do it in the UDF, do it in places that doesn't have to run inside the dbt interpreter, or the same interpreter as the one that dbt runs in. And then, I mean, there's kind of a scream for like better Python sandboxing. Like if Python had a way to like kind of run a mini interpreter within itself, you know, that'd be pretty cool, because you could sandbox that code and just like it will only run within that context. You know,
one of the engineers on the team built a very cool demo of compiling dbt to WebAssembly using, I think it's called Pyodide, and like running dbt in the browser. I don't know that that's all the way there yet, but I think something like that could be the future. Or we'll just rewrite dbt in Rust. I don't know, one or the other.
That sounds like a lot of work. But yeah, there are opportunities there. The Python transpiling stuff, like if like we need a really good library for SQL Alchemy is really great, but it's not quite, you know, what it needs to be, and there's a bunch of stuff missing, you know, from that. So it's like maybe that's a good area of contribution if you guys are looking for a new open source project, you know, open and give to the world as you hammer at it. It'd be like something like what SQL parse should have been or should be, you know.
Sure.
Awesome. Well, I want to be mindful of both of your time. So last question to you, Drew, is just what are you kind of, besides the semantic layer, what are you excited about with the future of dbt? Like, what's next that you're able to talk about that you're just really psyched for?
Yeah, semantic layer is occupying a lot of my time right now. Having a lot of fun working on it. Python models, which we talked about, I think are also really exciting. I think beyond that, I'm super interested in solving this problem of like collaboration across really big data teams. Like right now, the dbt mono repo thing doesn't really work that well when you have lots and lots of engineers working on something. And our approach to package management is good for something like dbt utils, but it's not really great if one team wants to depend on the outputs of another team's dbt project. And so figuring out how we can kind of better support those dependencies, and I wouldn't have brought it up, but Max, because you said it earlier, realize something that feels a little bit like a data mesh architecture. Like, I think that might actually be the next frontier.
Yeah, to governance, right? The emerging patterns on how teams work with data, with the toolkit is like, has to be defined yet. We're not there yet. There's more like problems than solutions in this area. Like, what's a data set? How does ownership work? Like, a lot of data ops stuff is not really figured out. Metadata management. We need like a metadata warehouse. That's like a data warehouse for your metadata that brings all everything that dbt knows, everything that Superset knows, everything that, you know, your database engine knows. I'll say one thing I'm excited about that's like a little bit on my radar now is to talk about reference implementation earlier. So as much as what I would like to contribute would be something like parametric pipeline, but I know it's impossible. I think what we want to do at Preset is like do a series of like blog posts around how we've used Fivetran for specific sources. So say our Fivetran for HubSpot, Fivetran for Recurly or Stripe, and how we share our dbt models and Superset dashboards and chart to show like, here's how we solve, so say payments or like SaaS analytics using these things. And then people can take the, the dbt project, which is essentially just a bunch of SQL, and see like, whether it's useful for them. And they can take the dashboards and charts too that kind of fit together all as code and, replicate and implement, fork, modify.
I think that's really cool. One thought that has been buzzing around in my head, if you build these dbt projects, you could drop some metrics in there, plug it right into Superset, you're off and running. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. So for sure, what we're planning on doing is having a single repo. So now, Superset supports headless BI now. So you can pretty much, we have a CLI where you can kind of push and pull objects. So you can go from GUI to code and from code to GUI. So any asset in Superset, like charts, dashboards, datasets, can be managed as code or in GUI. So now we can package, assumptions around the Fivetran model, the dbt project that fits with it, with the Superset assets on top of it as a continuously working thing. And then people can take that and modify the crap out of it to make it work for themselves,
Yeah, really cool.
Yeah, exciting. Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on, Drew. This was fun. I know we could easily go for a few more hours. So
thanks for having me on.
Appreciate you for jumping on for the time.